This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we welcome back award-winning journalist Paul Jay, who is working on a new documentary titled How to Stop a Nuclear War, based on extensive interviews with Daniel Ellsberg.
He connects the dots from the economics and mindset that drove the Cold War to the precarious state of nuclear policy today, including the recent expiration of the START Treaty. We then look at how neighborhoods within New York City are preparing to resist ICE raids.
New York City Councilwoman Alexa Villas joins us to talk about how her district in Brooklyn is organizing to protect itself against ICE.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. 2 weeks ago, we spoke with award-winning journalist and filmmaker Paul Jay about his upcoming documentary, How to Stop a Nuclear War. Scheduled for release in fall 2027, the film draws on in-depth interviews with Daniel Ellsberg and is narrated by Emma Thompson. It examines just how close humanity has come to nuclear catastrophe and why Ellsberg's decades-long warnings about nuclear policy and power remain urgently relevant today. We ran out of time in that conversation, so we're very glad to welcome Paul Jay back to the show to pick up where we left off. Today, we'll continue our discussion about the ongoing nuclear threat, how it's shaped by political and corporate interests, and what the public needs to understand in order to push for meaningful change. In addition to his work as a journalist and filmmaker, Paul Jay is the founder of TheAnalysis.News. For decades, he has investigated the inner workings of government, corporate power, and military policy, bringing together deep investigative reporting with a storyteller's clarity, helping audiences make sense of complex and often hidden forces that shape our world. Paul Jay, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Happy to be back.
Great. Well, before I get into questions, on February 5th, that signaled the end of the New START Treaty. Can you just very briefly, before we get into our other questions, let listeners know what that means?
Well, in some ways, it's more symbolic than anything. The New START Treaty, which limited the numbers of nuclear weapons Russia and the United States had, and was more or less effective in reducing numbers, it actually, more importantly, involved inspections and ongoing discussions and negotiations as to what was going on with each side's nuclear weapons. But that kind of ended already anyway. In 2020, during the pandemic, the Russians said they didn't want any more inspections, and the Americans said, okay. And then after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, most of the process broke down. They weren't inspecting, and they weren't even talking about it. So today is somewhat more symbolic because the treaty had more or less run out of steam, although both sides claimed they were keeping to the numbers. But as Dan Ellsberg often said, it isn't so much about the numbers. It's not irrelevant. But even at the quote-unquote lower numbers, we still face existential threats, and especially from miscalculation and accidents. So the worst part of the treaty ending is the stopping of the process itself. They don't even talk to each other, and that's very dangerous.
I wanted to start back at the beginning, just after World War II. What were the economic factors that led the U.S. to expand its nuclear weapons complex during the Cold War?
Well, you know, with this kind of question, I always have to decide where to start. Like, where's the beginning? And yes, no question, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki sort of introduces the nuclear era. But if you're talking about the economic roots, you kind of have to go back, and I'll go back a little further. There's several issues playing out when you start looking at why we're allowing this massive nuclear infrastructure that could end all life on Earth. Why does it still exist? And you need to go back, if you're, especially if you're talking about the economic factors, and there's several at play here. So let's start, quote unquote, at the beginning. The beginning is the American elites, and of course, elites throughout the world mostly, they hate socialism. And that didn't begin with the Cold War in 1945, 46, 47. It didn't even begin with the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. The hatred of socialism in the United States in particular, it begins on the record in the first speech in Congress in 1848, I'm going back, a rant against socialism and denouncing this attack on private property. And what was the private property under attack? Slaves. So it goes back, you know, the Red Scare, the first big Red Scare in the United States was 1871 at the time of the Paris Commune, when the workers of Paris took over and developed the most democratic form of socialist state you could imagine. Well, that was front page news all over the United States. And they were screaming blue murder, that these European socialists are coming to the United States and they're going to attack our private property. So this attack on the basic form of economic organization of the United States, and of course in the rest of the capitalist world, that was one of the most critical factors driving everything. Of course, we had a civil war. It turned out wage slavery was more effective than slavery. Then the United States conquers the West and wages genocide against Native people, and then plunders, attacks in the most brutal colonial way in the Philippines, throughout Latin America, Cuba, Guatemala, China, you name it. So this rise of U.S. imperialism, which is a combination of a plantation culture based on slavery, stealing land from the indigenous people, and then finding out, not only plundering the world, but finding out, boy, isn't war profiteering great? And this is where First World War, J.P. Morgan and others find out, boy, look at the money to be made out of war. So I'm telling this story because when people talk about the Manhattan Project, it usually starts at the beginning is the Manhattan Project, but it isn't the beginning. There's an America that exists that a Manhattan Project is born into. The question with the Manhattan Project is, and why I go into this backstory, is why keep building a bomb when you know there's no German bomb? Because that was the whole rationale for the Manhattan Project. At least that's what the scientists were being told, and later what the American public was told. Of course, the whole thing was secret until the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the building of the bomb was really an extension of what was going on throughout the whole late 19th century, what they learned from the First World War. War makes a lot of money. And if you have a nuclear bomb, not only does it create a whole massive nuclear weapons industry where you know, talk about war profiteering, but it also helps you establish a geopolitical regime in the world after World War II. This is one piece of it. There's another piece of it. Nothing important in history happens for one reason. You know, even at a level of a personal relationship, if you break up with your partner, nobody breaks up for one reason. There's always lots of reasons. And imagine something as complicated as important historical events like the nuclear era and the Cold War and such. But the other important piece of this was that the economic crisis of the 1930s, which was a crisis of a massive hyper-speculation from Wall Street, it was a crisis of overproduction. You can't keep lowering people's wages and then produce like mad, especially as the Industrial Revolution is giving rise to enormous productive capacity. You can't produce like mad and lower wages like mad and think everything's going to be honky-dory. So, of course, we have a crash for various reasons, but one of the reasons is the lack of purchasing power. And the New Deal helped plug the hole a little bit. It helped mitigate the crisis, at least to the extent that it subdued the rise of a really powerful socialist workers movement in the United States, which was certainly one of the objectives of the New Deal. And I would credit FDR. I think he actually really did want to avoid fascism in the United States. The New Deal model was also a way to avoid that. But it didn't really deal with it. And by 1938-39, unemployment was rising again. It was back up at 20-25% levels. The spending that really dealt with the crisis of the 30s was World War II. It was massive government spending at the level of that war. That's what created a kind of full employment. That's what plugged the hole that was sort of inherent in how the way capitalism worked. So anyway, jump ahead. The war ends. There's now two things have happened. One, you've had this massive government spending creating a kind of purchasing power that sort of put off the day of what had happened during the 30s. And you had a massive aerospace industry that had developed. Lockheed, Bell Aircraft, all the big companies that DuPont became much, much bigger. All the major companies, Standard Oil, everything took an enormous upswing in scale because they had guaranteed government contracts. And they made a killing. I mean, one of the untold stories of World War II is the same kind of war profiteering that became a scandal after World War I. The same thing was going on in World War II. So they have to deal with these issues. What is the solution here? So they come up with the problem. How do we maintain government spending, save the aerospace industry, keep economic stimulus going, you know, at sort of World War II levels as much as you can, but how do you justify it all if you don't have an enemy? Because the other alternative is go back to the New Deal, but at a much bigger, deeper, broader scale. Enormous government stimulus, enormous direct government employment programs, public ownership. In other words, you actually start strengthening the socialistic characteristics of the American economy. And there always were some, because that's part of how capitalism develops, like even a public post office is an example of it. They did not want to go back, they being the preponderance of the elites. The person who would have tried to go back would have been Vice President Henry Wallace, who wanted to go back, wanted at World War II. He called it, there was two contending visions of the world. Henry Luce, the guy, I think it was Time magazine or Look, I can't remember, but he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And their vision of the world was going to be the American century. Henry Wallace had an alternative vision. And same thing in 1942, he announces it at a filmed address. He calls it's going to be the century of the common man. And that will be a global New Deal. In other words, a kind of social democratic form of capitalism that would not only deal with the crisis in the U.S., but would even extend abroad. Well, honestly, I think he was dreaming. That isn't how capitalism works. And the reality of capitalism asserted itself. Yes, Wallace was useful to rally the working class during the war. But before the war ended, they got rid of him. And who do they replace him with? Of course, Harry Truman, who's easy to manipulate. The short of it all is they invent an existential enemy. They claim the Soviet Union is another form of Hitler. You know, in school, it's always the two forms of totalitarianism, Hitler and Soviet Union. But they weren't the same. And Dan, this is what started to turn Daniel Ellsberg's head around. Yes, Stalinism was extremely repressive in the United States. Could say a form of totalitarianism, but a very specific one, not the same as a capitalist Hitlerite one. The most important difference was the Stalin-Soviet Union primarily, on the whole, almost without exception, did not have a militarist external agenda. It was not a threat. And they invented one, they being the Truman administration, the Council on Foreign Relations. They literally consciously lied. And the reason I say consciously is because every year from 46 on, the CIA was producing documents titled, Is the Soviet Union a Threat to Western Europe and the United States? And every year, the CIA was telling the Truman administration, they're not a threat. They're in a defensive posture. They're afraid of us. So they needed an existential enemy to justify a massive military budget. Biden increased the nuclear budget by about 20% by his last year. Trump has already increased it perhaps as much as another 25%. We're already in the midst of an unmitigated arms race. And people talk about that as if it's the sad consequence of the policy of deterrence. But it's actually the objective of deterrence. If what you really wanted was just deterrence, you'd have a few nuclear submarines, and that would be it. Because the current nuclear sub fleet, well, there's 14 nuclear subs, between them, they can wipe out every single city in Russia and China. So what do you need more than that if there's such a thing supposedly as deterrence? Deterrence isn't the objective. The arms race is the objective. And spend more and more and more. So if you look at, you know, the current budget on nukes alone would pay for something like 200,000 teachers, just to put it in some perspective. And it's all a boondoggle. It does nothing. What Trump's added to the picture is the so-called Golden Dome, which is supposed to be this missile defense shield that will protect the United States from incoming nuclear missiles. It's a total fraud. You know, they say hitting incoming ICBMs is like hitting with a anti-ballistic missile. It's like hitting a bullet with a bullet. The difference between Trump's Golden Dome and Reagan's SDI, they're saying is artificial intelligence. Now, with AI, you can hit a bullet with a bullet. And even if it's true, and there's absolutely no evidence, there's not a single test that shows AI can hit this bullet with a bullet, but let's say it could, it can't distinguish between a bullet and the bullet, like the decoys. And one of the things they don't tell people is a basic principle of physics. Once the ICBM hits space, say the Russians or Chinese launch an ICBM. Once it's in space, it isn't propelled by rockets anymore because space doesn't have any resistance. It just flies. It may have a little bit of rocketry just for some final targeting. But basically, if you attach to the capsule a whack of decoys, whether they're balloons or anything, shrapnel or things that look like nuclear warheads, they will fly at the same speed because that's what happens in space. There is no way AI is going to distinguish between what's an actual incoming missile and a weapon and what is perhaps 1,000 decoys. So the whole thing is utter BS. The only thing more dangerous than this system not working at all is that it works a little, that maybe it could stop something, which scares the heck out of the Russians and the Chinese, which means they have to develop hypersonic weapons. They have to develop more ways to get around this system, which is why deterrence theory and supposed defense shield theory, actually the real objective is the arms race. Everybody knows this measures only give rise to countermeasures, which is all part of the boondoggle profit making. So your tax money is funding boondoggles, but nobody wants to talk about it because there's this taboo about nuclear weapons. Oh, you can't talk about it, or you're a traitor, or you're soft on communism, or you're soft on Russia, or soft on China. Decades and decades of this lying, Cold War lying, Cold War economics, Cold War exaggeration of the enemy, and Cold War paranoia and psychosis that they're out to get us. Who the hell wants to commit suicide? It's ridiculous. None of the leaders in any of the nuclear powers want to commit suicide, and everybody knows starting a nuclear war is precisely that. So the real danger is nuclear war by miscalculation and accident. Nobody's discussing it, and some very concrete things we could do to reduce the risk of that are not even on the agenda. Nobody pays any attention to it. And there are some real things we could be doing.
If you're just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm Maria Hall, here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Paul Jay, award-winning journalist, filmmaker, and founder of TheAnalysis.News. And he's working on a new documentary called How to Stop a Nuclear War. Well, Paul, both the U.S. and the USSR were famous for their Cold War propaganda in controlling the media and artists in order to promote their own agendas and, of course, demonize the other country. What role did the government propaganda play in Daniel Ellsberg's decision to leak the Pentagon Papers in 1971?
Well, he came to realize that the Vietnam War was based on a lie. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, when supposedly the North Vietnamese had attacked this American ship, was a lie. Even bigger lie, he came to realize, was that the American government, Lyndon Johnson, president, they knew very early on that this war was unwinnable, that the Vietnamese people had been fighting against the French. They fought against Japanese occupation. Again, they fought against the French. They fought against that this was a national liberation movement, and it wasn't going to give up, and it didn't matter what the Americans did. The vast popular opinion was against American intervention, was against the puppet regimes in South Vietnam, and in fact, I think in the Pentagon Papers, it's acknowledged in one of the studies that if there had been an election after World War II, Ho Chi Minh would have won the election. So he came to realize the extent to which this was based on a lie. The second thing which was he came to realize, and I'm not so sure it's part of the Pentagon Papers, but it's one of the most important big lies of the Vietnam War, is that the Cold War mythology, the basic story, was that the Soviet Union was going to use its military might to control the world. And that's the underlying lie of the Cold War. NSC 68, which I mentioned, this thing Nitze wrote, which became the essentially after 1950, the official doctrine of American foreign policy. The Soviet Union is going to militarily expand and take over the world. But hang on, the Vietnam War didn't fit that mold at all. Everybody that knew anything about it knew this was an indigenous national liberation movement. It was not an extension of Soviet militarism. It wasn't an extension of the Chinese militarism. It had nothing to do with Soviet military expansion. This was a people who didn't want to be dominated by the United States or its puppets. This is a pattern that was actually established in the war. Nobody really wants to talk about. And that's the Korean War. They call it the Forgotten War. And the short of it is, the Korean War, you had this guy Ri, who the Americans installed as president after the Japanese surrendered and left North Korea, South Korea. They install this guy Ri, who arrives there on an American plane, becomes president, and installs a vicious dictatorship, killing left-wingers, socialists, communists, thousands and thousands. People's Democratic Committees that spontaneously arose after the Japanese lost were slaughtered in South Korea. This is the guy the U.S. intervenes in a civil war almost identical to what happened in Vietnam. So what happened in Vietnam followed the pattern of the Korean War, which essentially was Soviet military threat is exaggerated or even invented, and it's used to install pro-American governments when possible through elections, and when not, install dictators through coups or even direct military intervention, like Vietnam. This was part of the model of how you establish what the Council on Foreign Relations called the grand area. The fundamental thesis plan was, do not allow any countries that are not already part of the Soviet sphere to enter the Soviet sphere. That was the mission one coming out of World War II. And the objective was, by any means necessary, whether it's manipulating elections in Italy, whether it's funding the fascists in Greece, invading and getting involved in the civil war in Korea or a civil war in Vietnam, or backing the fascists in Indonesia who killed something like a million people inside of about 4 or 5 weeks, installing perhaps as many as 200 dictators between 1945 and 1990.
Paul, finally, given all of that you've told us about, can you remind our listeners of some very concrete steps that people can take, I mean, individually and collectively, to protect ourselves and our world from this ongoing threat of nuclear war?
Well, I know when people listen to this analysis, it sounds like overwhelming. Some people, I'm sure your audience knows a lot of what I've been saying, but a lot of ordinary people don't. And it starts to really challenge people's identity as being Americans. So it's kind of hard to listen to sometimes. But most importantly, people feel like it's overwhelming. What can we do? If there's a nuclear war, we're all dead anyway. And so, you know, it's like an all or nothing proposition. But it isn't. I don't think there's any leadership or any class or elites in any nuclear power that wants to commit suicide. I don't think any of them are going to deliberately start a nuclear war. It's, let's put it this way, highly unlikely. In extreme circumstances, you could imagine the use of a tactical nuke. But so far, we haven't seen it. The Americans didn't, even though they contemplated it, didn't use it in Korea, didn't use it in Vietnam. The Russians didn't use it in Afghanistan. So right now, that kind of deliberate, conscious use. But what about accidental use? Miscalculation and introducing AI makes it even more dangerous. So here's some things we can demand to reduce the risk of nuclear war. Number one, no golden dome. People should understand why a boondoggle phony anti-ballistic missile system, it's not just a boondoggle and a waste of money. It's dangerous because it makes other Russia and China think that what if it could take out some of our second strike capacity? What if it means the U.S. could now launch a successful first strike? So it destabilizes things. Number two, ICBMs and launch on warning are either just sitting ducks because you either use them or lose them. So you see something coming in, and either you launch the ICBMs or they get taken out. Well, how do you know what's coming in is real? What if it's geese or radar bouncing off the moon, which has happened before? What if it's AI hallucinating? There's only one way to know something is real, and that's let it hit. And why wouldn't you let it hit? Because you can't stop it anyway. So you might as well wait and see if it's real, because if you fire your ICBMs and it turns out it's not real, you've just guaranteed the other side is going to send something real back at you. Number three, no first strike, no threat of first strike. All it does is create a crisis situation again, where something can be mistaken for a real first strike and starts a nuclear war. No testing. One of the ways to freeze the modernization that's taking place, not just in the United States, but in Russia and in China, is the whole idea that if you can't test, it's hard to modernize. So no testing, which helps create a nuclear freeze. Very important, no AI and nuclear command and control. It's obvious how dangerous that is, but it's proceeding at an enormous speed.
This is G. Gordon Liddy. I urge you to tune in to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 on your FM dial. If you don't, I'll break both your legs.
bring you like I'm sexy love. You me like anything in the world. Spirits bring you like a beauty life. We are one. It is crazy, it's true. This is a song for you.